Michael Nava, the award-winning author of the acclaimed Henry Rios mystery series, explores the Mexican Revolution in his novel, The City of Palaces, winner of two International Latino Book Awards in 2015. I'm Angela Elam for UMKC's New Letters on the Air, and I talked with this now-retired California lawyer in 2014 at the Hall Center for the Humanities while he was a guest of the Latino Writers Collective at a KU workshop. Here's Michael Nava with what inspired The City of Palaces.
My interest is personal. I am the great-grandchild of refugees who came to the United States from Mexico during the revolution. It's kind of a hidden revolution. In the years between 1910 and 1920, when Mexico was embroiled in a terrible civil war, think of Syria as a modern-day analogy, over a million refugees poured across the border to the United States. It was the first great wave of Mexican migration to this country, and among those migrants were my great-grandparents. And I grew up with stories about it, but no one really talked about it much, and I find that many Latinos of my generation know nothing about the revolution, much less many white Americans.
Do you think it's because it's not really taught in our schools? When I think about my history classes, we didn't deal with that. Of course, we didn't deal with a lot of the modern 20th century, so.
Yeah, but everyone's heard of the Russian Revolution.
That's true.
And yet the Mexican Revolution, which I argued was probably more significant in terms of its long-term consequences, is not mentioned in world history courses at the high school level or in college. You have to seek them out, really.
And it's kind of crazy when you think about it, because Mexico's our neighbor. You would think we'd be more interested.
Not only is Mexico our neighbor, but the demographic revolution is on. And in California, where I live, Latinos now make up the largest population of the state. So increasingly, to understand the Mexican community in this country, one needs to have a grasp of where we came from and things like the revolution, which created this wave of migration. It's as if we know nothing about the potato famine that brought the Irish here, or the pogroms that brought Eastern European Jews here at the beginning of the last century. We as Americans know about those events in other countries which contributed to the development of our country in terms of immigrants. But we know nothing about Mexico and the forces in Mexico which drove people across the border.
There's so much history in The City of Palaces. How long did it take you to research this?
I started doing the research in 1995. The book was published in 2014. So for almost 20 years, you know, I have other things to do, of course.
Because you work full-time as a lawyer.
Right, I was practicing law and having a life.
In what way do you think being an attorney has helped you as a novelist?
Well, it gave me material for the Rios books. Some of the courtroom scenes in the Rios novels are drawn from my own experience as a trial lawyer. I started as a prosecutor, or from reading the transcripts of trials. People who read those books are often impressed by the authenticity of the courtroom scenes, as well they should be. But also it gave me kind of an intellectual and moral structure, right and wrong, especially in criminal law and sort of the ambiguities that exist in criminal law. So I'm grateful for that experience. And also because I write as a lawyer, that's what I do. I'm a research attorney. It gives me an opportunity to hone my ability to write. I tell law students there's no such thing as good legal writing. There's only good writing. You know, whether you're writing a novel or a brief, there's only good writing, and the same rules apply. So that goes along with my admonition to them to think of themselves as professional writers. And it certainly helps me to be writing all the time.
Right.
Many lawyers are one-time English majors.
Yeah. Well, I thought I would get you to read from the beginning of The City of Palaces. It gives us a sense of the Mexico that we're starting with in the beginning of this novel.
Rodrigo Sarmiento, like his son, was a physician. He had long ago given up medicine in favor of writing manifestos against the government, printed at his own expense that he posted all over the city. Sarmiento sometimes stopped and read one of his father's broadsheets, but he rarely got to the end. While they began rationally, even eloquently, they quickly degenerated into paranoid rants against Don Porfirio Diaz and his government. His father's fury at the despot who had governed Mexico for almost 30 years was as much a personal vendetta as the product of an abstract allegiance to democratic principles. His father and Don Porfirio had once been comrade in arms. When the French had invaded Mexico in 1862, forcing the elected president, Don Benito Juarez, from the capital, his father had accompanied him as his personal physician and close advisor. Diaz had been one of Don Benito's generals, and his string of victories against the vastly superior French army had helped finally drive them out of Mexico. After the execution of the puppet Emperor Maximiliano and the restoration of the Republic, Sarmiento's father had promoted Diaz as the logical successor to the presidency upon Don Benito's retirement. But Diaz had little patience, and after Juarez was reelected in 1871, unsuccessfully attempted to overthrow him. To Sarmiento's father, the failed coup was a betrayal of the democratic principles he believed he and Don Porfirio shared. This was only to be the beginning of his disillusionment with Diaz. In 1876, after a second revolt against the government, Diaz installed himself in the presidency and was repeatedly elected with increasingly implausible majorities. The attitude of the dictator towards Sarmiento's father was one of amused contempt. It was an attitude mirrored in the government's newspapers, where his father became an object of ridicule, deranged Dr. Rodrigo. One newspaper cartoonist caricatured him as a latter-day Martin Luther nailing a scroll to the door of an outhouse. The caption explained that the paper on which he wrote his screeds could serve a useful purpose for those entering the facility. Sarmiento stepped into the room. "Father," he said loudly. The old man looked up. "Ugh, what are you doing here?" "Your brother told me you'd been arrested," he said. "I've come to take you home." "My brother," he spat, "that fathead bootlicker." Sarmiento let the statement pass. His uncle Caetano, unlike his father, had remained in Diaz's good graces and had been rewarded with a seat in the Senate. His father, however, was just warming to the subject. "My brother followed me here from Spain 40 years ago after I'd made a place for myself, and he is still riding my coattails." He glared at his son. "I made Sarmiento an illustrious name in this country, and now my brother defiles it by collaborating with the dictator." At moments like this, Sarmiento had learned to detach himself and regard his father as if he were simply a particularly choleric patient. He observed that the old man's hands were trembling and his face was drawn. "When did you last eat?" Sarmiento asked. "When I was last fed," his father replied. "Gather your things, father, and I will take you home." "No," he said with more petulance than anger. "I am a prisoner of conscience, and here I will remain until I am charged, tried, and vindicated." "Father," Sarmiento replied, "there will be no charges and no trial. You were arrested because you insist on posting your broadsheets on the door of the National Palace. Your brother has secured your release." "You understand nothing," his father said. He gestured at the paper-strewn table. "Go away, Miguel, I have work to do." He sank back into his chair and began to write and mumble, "I must rouse Mexico against this tyrant. He stopped, looked at his hands as if he were seeing them for the first time, and then gazed at his son with the same expression. In a calm, concerned voice, he said, "I worry about you, Miguel." Sarmiento had become accustomed to these abrupt shifts in his father's mood when the cloud of mental confusion dissipated for a moment and he was his own self. Looking into his eyes, he saw not the crazy old man his father had become, but the parent he had once been, stern, demanding, even frightening, but always gruffly loving. "Why is that, father?" "I can smell the alcohol on your breath, and it's what, 10 o'clock in the morning? Your drinking accelerates, and we both know why, to wash away the memory. But that's all it is, Miguel, a memory. What cannot be changed is best forgotten." "How can I forget, father? I killed that girl, that child, my child. You said so yourself. You called me a murderer."
That's from the beginning of The City of Palaces by Michael Nava. You're listening to New Letters on the Air. I find it really interesting that you, as a lawyer, always dealing with facts and issues. Why did you choose to tell this story as a novel and not nonfiction?
Well, you know, I'm a novelist and it's in my blood. I mean, I've always been a storyteller, and long before I thought about becoming a lawyer, I was writing.
Including poetry?
Including poetry.
Do you ever attempt poetry anymore?
I lost the gift in law school, actually. I think law drove the muse away. She said, oh, you're going to be a lawyer? I'm leaving. So
I don't think your muse was driven away. I think your muse became interested in something else.
Yes,
so,
she did. Yeah, poetry turns out to be great training for writing fiction, though, because you really learn language and compression and finding the right words. So I'm grateful for that training. So I found in writing the Rios books, which were about this gay detective, that I could write about the experience of being gay in a way that was palatable to readers who were not gay, because they would get involved in the mystery and they would read it for that reason, and then I could sort of slip in some other things. And, you know, by the end of that series, the Rios books were being reviewed everywhere, from the New York Times to People magazine. So I had a wide audience, and a lot of my audience were people who are not gay, who would tell me they're not sure they would have read a book with a gay character, but because it was a mystery and because it was so well written, they got involved in it, and they ended up really having a great deal of empathy for the main character and having an understanding of his experience of being a gay man in the straight world. Similarly, I wanted to educate people about a crucial part of Mexican history, and I thought a teaspoon of sugar would make the historical medicine go down.
And it's apparent that what you were doing with the Henry Rios mysteries worked well, because it won so many Lambda Literary Awards. How many won a
Six.
Lambda? Six out of the seven. Wow, that's pretty
Still
amazing.
Still bitter about the one that didn't. I almost had a no-hitter there.
Well, in the City of Palaces, you have a gay man who is the cousin of the main character. He escapes Mexico so he won't be accused of sodomy and comes back later. You still are addressing gay issues in a different time period. I think that was eye-opening, too.
Well, I write about the downtrodden, and everything that happens to this character, Luis, is historically accurate. There was, in fact, a famous drag ball in Mexico City that was raided in 1900. About 41 men were arrested. Many of them were sentenced to a life imprisonment at a terrible, terrible prison. In fact, the number 41 in Mexico was synonymous with homosexuality, so much so that I'm told that some modern skyscrapers skip the 41st floor. They'll go from 40 to 42 because 41 signifies something that Mexicans don't want to be associated with.
I didn't know that. The two main characters of the book, Sarmiento and Alicia, meet, and we get to see how their relationship blossoms. And I loved both of these characters. Is there any basis in life for these two particular people?
Miguel Sarmiento he's a doctor, a scientist, an atheist, a rationalist, and a liberal in the late 19th century sense of a liberal, someone who believed in the principles of democratic governance and so forth. Alicia, his wife, is descended of an aristocratic family in Mexico, uneducated in the way that even rich women were uneducated at that period, deeply spiritual, deeply committed to a certain kind of Catholicism. And for him, I just drew on my own experience, really. I mean, he's kind of a modern figure, conflicted, filled with moral ambiguity and doubt. She was harder because the challenge with Alicia was to draw a religious character with respect for her beliefs without being condescending, and to really try to understand that. And for her, I just drew upon the experience of the women of my family. You know, I come from a working class Mexican-American background. My grandmother in particular was deeply pious and very kind. And so I sort of drew upon my experience of her in creating Alicia.
We should say, too, that Alicia is very scarred, both emotionally and outwardly, on her face from having smallpox.
Yes.
And I won't give away the whole bit of the story, but there's such a great unfolding as this goes. And I'm going to get you to read one part of the book where we find out part of what is torturing the main character. And it really is the thing that starts an intimacy that really opens up their relationship and brings them closer together. And it's right after Sarmiento's father has died.
Yes.
And she does something that women are supposed to never do, which is to go see him in the place where he lives.
Yes.
For the first time. And She wants to be there unaccompanied, but the man who brings her, the porter, Sarmiento, gives him permission to stand outside, and if he hears anything strange, to come in. So she walks into his rooms, and I thought we'd pick it up from here.
So Alicia's gone to his rooms over her aristocratic mother's strenuous objections, because this is the Victorian era. This is the era when piano legs were covered with pantalettes because legs were considered shocking, even on an inanimate object. So here she is. "Your rooms are charming," she said. Indicating the brandy and the revolver on the table, she added, "I feel I may have interrupted you." He sat beside her and picked up the revolver. "This was my father's gun. He carried it with him when he accompanied Don Benito Juarez in the war against the French invaders. I found it beneath his pillow when I discovered his body. An old soldier's habit, I suppose, although he was no soldier, really. He was a scientist, a healer, a Democrat." He paused to collect himself. "In every way, thoroughly admirable, I will never be even half the man he was." Without asking her permission, he poured brandy into the glass and drank it. "You told me once he was the only person who knew you fully, and that you were the only person he loved." Miguel sighed. "Yes, it is strange to feel orphaned at my age, and yet I do. No one will ever know me as my father did." "We are all known completely by the one who created us, Miguel," she said. "I am often comforted by the words of the psalm that says, 'Even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is as bright as day, for darkness is as light with you.'" "I am an atheist, Alicia, as you know. My darkness is not illuminated by a supernatural light." He swallowed some brandy. "That is why I have decided," he faltered, then drew a deep breath. "I've decided I can never marry. I cannot bring my darkness into your life." "Is that why you have not been to see me?" she asked softly. "Because you wish to break things off between us?" "I do not wish it," he said. "I have no choice." They sat for a moment, and then she placed her hand on his. "I will accede to your decision, but not without knowing why. This darkness of yours. Tell me its cause, and let me understand, so we can part as friends." He finished his brandy. He sighed convulsively, as if he were about to sob, grasped her hand, and said, "When I finish, you will not wish even to be my friend. Nonetheless, I will tell you, so that you will know you are blameless." He stood up and paced the floor as he spoke. "My youth was not a credit to my family. I was heedless and self-indulgent, a disappointment to my father in my studies and in my deportment. I was expelled from the medical school for drinking and gambling, but even that disgrace was odd enough to change my ways. I persisted in dishonoring my father's name. There was a girl, Paquita, employed as a maid in my father's house. I led her to believe I was in love with her, to lure her into my bed. After I'd taken her virginity, I turned my back on her." "A sordid story," he said, glancing at her, "but not an uncommon one for men of my class. In this case, however, she became pregnant with my child. When she told me, I panicked. I persuaded her it was best for both of us that the child not be born. I believed my medical training would be sufficient." He stopped in his tracks. He looked at her. "I have never told this to anyone. Only my father knew." Unsteadily, she said, "Please, continue." "I promised her if she let me abort the child, I would marry her. I took her to a room at a filthy inn to perform the procedure, but I had vastly overestimated my abilities. She began to bleed. She bled and bled. I could not stop the hemorrhaging. Oh, the poor child. I ran through the streets, covered with her blood, to my father's house. I told him everything and begged him to come and save her life. He came, but too late. She and the child, I could see it would have been a boy, were dead." He crumpled into a chair and picked up the brandy, drinking from the bottle. "My father sent me away that very night to Veracruz to await his instructions." "This is why you left the country," he nodded. "My father told Paquita's parents the truth. He also told them he had sent me away and promised I would never return to Mexico. He told me he would give me one final chance to make a man of myself before he cut me off completely. I went to Heidelberg, where I entered medical school. After Heidelberg, I went to Paris to continue my studies. I lived like a monk, trying to atone for my crime, trying to forget, but every morning I woke up in a foreign city I remembered. I begged my father to let me return home, but as long as Paquita's parents were alive, he felt obliged to keep his promise to them. It was only after they were both gone that he wrote me and told me to come home. He glanced at her and then away. I have discovered, however, there is no home for me. Like Cain, I am marked with guilt, and I carry it everywhere I go, now and until the end of my life. As long as my father was alive, there was someone to shoulder part of my burden, but now he is gone, and its weight crushes me. He looked at her. I am a murderer, Alicia. I killed that girl and our child. There is no way to atone but with my life. A chill passed through her, for in that moment she understood what she had interrupted. You cannot atone for one murder by committing another. Not murder, execution. Your despair is selfish, she exclaimed. If you wish to atone with your life, not with your death. You have seen how this city overflows with the suffering of the poor, like the girl you betrayed. Sacrifice yourself to their need. Forget yourself by serving them. Like you, Alicia, is that what you do? She breathed deeply, exhaled. I once sat before a mirror and pitied myself, lamenting the husband I would never have, the children I would never give birth to. I took to heart the cruel barbs that were directed at me and the expressions of disgust and let them hurt me. Doing so changed nothing, not my face, not my life. So I chose to step away from the mirror, to pretend not to hear or see the contempt. It brought me relief, but it was not until I lost myself in the work of aiding others that I felt peace. I am not the little plaster saint I am made out to be by the women in my circle who pity me for being a disfigured old maid. I am merely trying, like everyone else, to find some happiness in this world. The path that most women take was closed to me, so I had to find another. The first object of my charity has always been myself. I have never met anyone like you, he said. No one so kind, so filled with love. You're right, Alicia. You're not a plaster saint. You're... Stop, Miguel. Please. She looked away. We are speaking of you. What you did to Paquita was monstrous. Your guilt is justified. But you are not unforgivable. God forgives you, forgives even your disbelief. I forgive you, Miguel. It does not matter if we never see each other again. No, in my heart, you are and will always be cherished. Overwhelmed by the sentiment, she rushed from the room before he could reply. In the carriage, she pulled the curtain closed and wept for the girl and the child Miguel had killed, for Miguel himself, and lastly, for her own loss. She could not imagine, having told her his secret, he would want to see her again. She could only hope it was enough for his peace of mind that he had been able to tell her.
That's from The City of Palaces by Michael Nava. This is New Letters on the Air. Yeah, that's where they really have that moment of intimacy and looking at each other. And she is no saint herself. She's got her own story to tell.
She does.
I love the way that you grapple with religion, since he's an atheist and she's such a good practicing Catholic. And we get to know the priest who eventually marries them and some of the things that happen with the church within the culture. Mm-hmm. And then recognizing the influence that that has with what's going on with the Yaquis. Talk a little bit about the Yaquis.
So my grandfather, Ramon Acuña, was a full-blooded Yaqui. The Yaquis are a Mexican tribe of Indians who live in the northwest state of Sonora, which is adjacent to Arizona. At the end of the 19th century, the Diaz government decided to exterminate the tribe in order to take over their land, which was quite fertile. It's very similar to what we did in this country with our indigenous people. We kept driving them farther and farther west and put them on reservations and killed them. The Mexicans did the same thing with some of their indigenous people. The Yaquis, however, fought back. They were fierce warriors and they would not go peacefully. At the end of the 19th century, a few of them made it across the border to Arizona, which they now have a reservation outside of Tucson. And my grandfather's family was one of them, and he was born in Arizona. So I wanted to weave that story also into the novel.
So you write during the day with your work?
Yes. I work as a lawyer on the staff of the California Supreme Court.
Ah.
So I write opinions for the judges, and I write them specifically in death penalty cases.
Oh, my goodness. You must encounter some intense stories along the way.
Yes, there are, yeah, there are a lot of stories.
And then you come home and write at night or early morning, or what do you do as a writer?
So I actually write in the morning before I go to work. I spend an hour writing in bed, like Proust, although I have a laptop and he didn't.
Yeah.
So that's the time I give myself to write.
When you wrote all of those detective stories, did you do the same thing? You were writing in the morning every day?
No, I was younger then. So I would work during the day, and then I would go to the gym, and then I would come home and eat something, and then I would write for 2 or 3 hours in the evening until midnight. But I can't do that anymore. I'm asleep by 10 o'clock.
Yeah. When you decided to finish up the 7 mystery novels with Henry Rios, did you plan to write this book? I know you've been researching it for 20 years. Has this been a book you've been wanting to write that long?
Funny story. So I had actually become interested in the story of the Yaquis, and I'd also become interested in a silent screen actor named Ramon Navarro. Ramon Navarro was like one of the first generation of great international movie stars, along with Valentino and Chaplin and Pickford, and he's most famous for the 1926 version of Ben-Hur. It happens that Navarro was a Mexican immigrant who, like my great-grandparents, his family had been forced to cross the border during the war. He ended up in Hollywood, where he basically hung out until he was discovered. And in addition to being a Mexican refugee, he was also homosexual, and pretty openly so. So my grandfather had once told me that he ended up in Hollywood in around 1920, and he had been an extra in Westerns because he looked very much like the Indian on the nickel. So in the process of kind of verifying his story, I found that, yes, this is actually true. You know, Native Americans were used in Hollywood in the teens and early 20s as extras in these Westerns. So I imagined this story where a Yaqui boy meets a Mexican boy like Navarro, and the two become friends, and one of them becomes a great movie star. And that was the novel I was going to write. But as I started to work on it, I realized that there was so much backstory about where the Mexican kid had come from, about the revolution, about his family, that what was going to be one book has now become four. And so this is the first of four books, and they don't even get to Hollywood until the third book.
So we can look forward to more. That's wonderful.
Yes.
Yeah, well, wonderful for us. You've still got to write them.
The second book takes place in Arizona in a border town called Douglas, which is an actual town. It's where Jose, the boy,
the son of Alicia
and Miguel, meets Mateo, who is the young Yaqui boy. Then they become friends.
So you are going to get to tell the story that you started out telling. It's just going to end up later in the series.
I am. It's just going to take me another decade.
Let's hope not. Now that he's retired from the law, Michael Nava calls his proposed quartet The Children of Eve. And this first novel, The City of Palaces, won 2 International Latino Book Awards in 2015. The next year, his reimagined beginning for his Henry Rios series was published in an edgier novel titled Lay Your Sleeping Head. I talked with Michael Nava at the Hall Center for the Humanities while he was at KU for a 2014 Migrant Youth Writers Workshop with the Latino Writers Collective. For more, visit newletters.org or follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, or Twitter at New Letters Radio. A production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, today's show was produced with Megan Fulkin, Sean Weir, Elizabeth Albano, Anju Christopher, Coy Duggar, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.